Welcome. Good evening. Some of us were having a conversation a few days ago about right view. And as we went around, I heard from everybody, there were many interesting ways that people practice with right view and understand right view. Also at that time I thought, even though they're coming from people's experience, none of them sounded quite like the way the Buddha taught right view. Or maybe they sounded somewhat like that, but it made me wonder. The doubt arose for me of, I wonder if people are familiar with the teaching of right view as taught by the Buddha in all its different aspects. And it struck me how important this is. It's like we could see right view as like the road map to where we're going in practice. You could say, well, isn't what we're actually doing, our conduct and practice and meditation and precepts, that's the actual way it all plays out. Isn't that most important? And maybe we could say that's equally as important. But if we don't have the map of where we're going, then we can be going full speed ahead on some road, but we don't know where it might end up. And so I think that right view is something that could be talked about and contemplated forever, our whole life of practice, and taught in many ways as the tradition of Dharma developed over time. And but all of these ways are like these road maps. So we could also argue that before we pull out the roadmap, let's first just, you know, warm up the car and start driving around, make sure that the car works. So that may be good too. But gas is expensive and time is short. So before we drive down too many dead-end roads, I think really good to take a look at the map. I mean, we all know some aspects of the map, I know, but clarifying the map, and even maybe choosing which map to use. We could even say that the Buddha offered various different maps. And maybe there's some debate about whether the destination is always the same place throughout the Buddhist tradition. There is some debate about that. But the destination is pretty similar place, I think, in through most of these teachings. But there's many different routes to get there. And the just like you can, is it Google Maps or MapQuest, or maybe all of these days have that amazing feature where you can, you enter your starting point and your destination point and press the button and it shows you the road. But then you can, and you can look at the time it takes and the miles, and then you can drag the route, right, across to the other side of the map and to some other road. Do you know these programs? It's amazing. You can say, well, you know, I'm going to San Francisco. You plug it in and it'll probably tell you to go up 17 to 85 to 280. And you can see how long that takes and how many miles. And then just to compare, you can take your mouse and just drag that line, that connecting line, you can drag it over to Highway 1. And it pops right in there and it goes... and it fills in. You only need to drag it part of the line and it fills in the rest of the... It'll, from where you drag it, it'll fill in the rest of that route and it'll tell you it's that many more minutes and miles. So there are different roads to the same destination. And it partly depends on our disposition. I think that's why there's sometimes said to be 84,000 different teachings, is because there's so many different personalities and inclinations and tendencies and enjoyments. So there's many paths. Even at different times in our life, like, you know, if I have the time, I actually really prefer to go up Highway 1 to San Francisco. It's so beautiful along the coast, even though it takes a little more time. So the Buddha and then many teachers after the Buddha offer these different possibilities. So maybe tonight I'll just offer to start the basic right view, the basic roadmap from the first turning of the Dharma wheel, where right view and right, you know, I think when we get into these discussions, people get concerned. This sounds so divisive to say there's a right view and a wrong view. Maybe okay if it's to be really clear about that. There's one early sutra where the Buddha says something like the greatest suffering in this world comes from holding wrong view or false views. So there really are wrong views in the sense of like they're just like dead end roads. They really are roads on the map, but they really will not lead to the destination. And right view, Sanskrit, samyak drishti. And so samyak can mean something like complete. Sometimes we use that term anuttara samyak sambodhi, which means unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So that samyak means like complete. Complete view. Like nothing's missing on this roadmap. So this early teaching is kind of in two parts. There's the conventional right or complete view. View is also kind of a nice word too, because it's kind of like, you know, you're looking out towards the destination. It's a view over the whole terrain and where the road goes. Or we could also say understanding, right understanding of which path to take. So the kind of conventional right view is basically how karma works. And a few weeks ago we had a conversation about karma. But that wholesome intentions to benefit others and ourselves, lead to happiness. And unwholesome intentions, in other words, intentions to harm ourselves or others lead to unhappiness. Kind of obvious, but the Buddha did teach that. Maybe just a reminder. Because even though it's obvious, we definitely do forget. So Buddha says, that is how the conventional world works. It holds true. Thus we have things like precepts. And the kind of, maybe we could say ultimate, if that's the conventional right view, we could say the ultimate right view is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths lay out the path as well as the goal. Because if we're thinking this is all a map, but a map to where? So the Four Noble Truths are the understanding, the view or understanding of the goal of peace, the goal of ease. The goal of joy, presence, and open compassion, and all of that. All the reasons we come to practice, probably. And in Zen, sometimes goal gets a bad rap. Don't talk about the goal, just do the practice. And I think that's why it gets a bad rap, because it's like if you're thinking too much about the destination, you'll forget the practice in the present. If you're looking at a picture of San Francisco while you're driving up Highway 1, you'll go off the road. But before you get on the road, it's good to look at maybe not the picture of San Francisco, but maybe you have some idea. That's where you want to go. So I think without a goal to start with, it kind of doesn't make that much sense. And luckily, I think we usually don't have that problem. Even if we think, well, I don't really know why I'm practicing, I just do it. At least to start with, you probably did have some reason to take it up. And as long as you have that destination in mind, then you don't need to keep looking back at the picture of San Francisco. But if you forget where you're going, and this I think does happen, sometimes we practice for many years and we basically forgot why we're doing it. Again, maybe two different sides to this could be just fine as long as we're totally enthusiastic about this drive up the coast and we're just totally enjoying it, then we maybe don't have to worry about where we're going because we know we're going there. But if it's kind of like, oh, we've been driving up this coast for so long and like, why are we doing this again? What's up there? Like, in fact, maybe we should just turn around because I don't even remember why. Then we have to pull out the picture of the beautiful Golden Gate Bridge in the fog of the park, the theater, whatever we're doing in San Francisco. So we could say of the Four Noble Truths. Anyone who hasn't heard the Four Noble Truths? Great. Anyone who hasn't thought of the Four Noble Truths today? Oh, a few. I often don't. I go through many days without thinking about them. And so therefore, let's remember them today. The third noble truth is kind of like San Francisco. It's kind of like where we're going. The cessation, it's called. It's worded kind of negatively. if we called San Francisco like the cessation of Santa Cruz. It might not sound so interesting to go there. All right. So that's why Buddha didn't always call it cessation. Sometimes he called it bliss. And then, you know, in order to motivate us to want to go there. But once we're like on the journey, then he said, well, just in case you have a really fixed view of where you're going, basically you should just remember all the horribly miserable places you could go instead of San Francisco. And then you don't need to define San Francisco so much. It's just that you know you don't want to be in these other run-down towns along the way or in opposite directions. Dangerous, crime-infested cities where the weather is always dark and it's cold and nobody's friendly. It's not one of those places. We won't really tell you what it's like, but it's not like that. It's definitely not like that. San Francisco is one of the cleanest cities in the country. So the first noble truth is basically like there's something. I don't know if this metaphor is going to like work out completely, but like there's something not completely satisfactory about Santa Cruz or wherever we are, and that's why we're going on this ship to San Francisco. It's not like we want to diss Santa Cruz. It's just that the way our present situation is, our life right now, it's not as complete as it could be. There's some dis-ease. I just get stuck in places. And so let's just see if this journey offers something beneficial to my life and therefore others. So it's just acknowledging, Buddha says, understanding suffering, understanding discontent, acknowledging there's a problem here. Sometimes, again, I think in Zen we maybe can skip over this somehow. We emphasize so much like the cool ease of Zazen that we forget to really acknowledge, no, when I'm actually distracted from Zazen mind, things don't go so well. Things are really difficult. And there is this possibility of some freedom and ease from this difficulty. I recently heard some Dharma talk where I think this is kind of a debatable topic. This teacher said something like, well, you know, it's not really like you end suffering. He's like, the Buddha didn't really end. The Buddha still suffered, and we all suffer too. It's just about finding, you know, being more who we really are. And I think that's a good teaching to say it's being more who we really are. But in this view of the Four Noble Truths, I think that's something to examine: is do we really feel like this path leads to the end of discontent, or at least the lessening of discontent? But my understanding, as a naive idealist that I am, and my understanding of, you know, what the sutras say, is that the Buddha realized the end of suffering, the end of discontent. Now, I haven't realized that. So am I just going on faith? Yes. I am. I have great faith in the Buddha because so many things he said that I've tried out seem to work really well. So his his batting average is really good. If a lot of the things didn't work out, then I maybe would start disbelieving other things. But this is one of the main things he said. And it has, I would say that this fairy teaching of the Four Noble Truths has decreased the discontent in this particular life. So going on that principle, I think, well, if I continue to practice and stay on the road, which is very hard to do because there's many scenic things down those dead-end side roads, then it will keep going this way. So first we really understand suffering, and I think part of understanding suffering is understanding what it is seeing that the Buddha's definition of suffering, briefly, is basically like constriction, like we say grasping or holding. That's like the definition of discontent. And so that's something to explore in our own experience. Do we, at the time, we feel particularly discontent? Do we feel like we're holding both bodily tension and mental tension, and particularly we have a constricted view. We're holding some belief. Usually, I keep noticing this, that when I feel that constriction called suffering or discontent, at the time that I feel that, I can almost always identify, and when I can't identify, I would propose that if I look further, I would be able to identify there's some belief that I'm actually holding that's not serving me well. So we see that this discontent comes from a misunderstanding of reality, holding a kind of a false belief. And then we see the origin of the suffering. It can be talked about in various ways, but we could say the origin is the basically building up of these false beliefs that then we hold on to. So again, view is all like woven through this. In the early sutras, as we say, craving is the origin of suffering, or this constriction. But if we look back, what's the origin of the craving? It's again, I would say, this basic underlying misunderstanding of how things are. The fact that I really want something I don't have, or I want things to be different than they are, is based on a kind of misunderstanding. These are, of course, huge topics, but you've probably heard them before. So then the third noble truth is that the cessation of the discontent comes from the cessation of this wanting things to be different, which comes from the cessation of these misunderstandings. We could even say it comes from the cessation of wrong view, or kind of false views. So you could say right view is the way to realize the cessation of wrong view, and therefore the cessation of discontent. And in fact, that is the fourth noble truth, is the way to realize the cessation of discontent, and it starts with right view. Right view is a kind of antidote to misunderstanding. And interestingly, right view, which is the first of this eightfold path that leads to the cessation of suffering in the Four Noble Truths, right view is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It's this funny kind of circular thing, like does anyone know the name of that creature that's like a dragon?
Uroboros.
That's Uroboros?
I'm not sure that's how you pronounce it, but
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, Uroboros. Uroboros is like kind of like it's eating its tail, so it's maybe I've never seen a moving video of a Uroboros, but I can picture it almost like moving a rat, like it's eating the tail, and it keeps as it's eating that part of its tail, it keeps moving forward too, like it's rotating or something. It's kind of like that, the way that right view is part of the path that leads to the cessation of wrong view, and therefore the cessation of suffering. And the right view is the view of this, how this whole process works. And then the other factors on the Eightfold Path are basically about conduct, which goes back to the conventional right view, is that helpful, unharmful actions lead to happiness and peace, and at least conventional peace, and harmful actions lead to unhappiness. It's kind of like that's built into the Eightfold Path too, called right conduct, right speech, right livelihood. Those are the way to enact our karma in the world, to accord with things as they are, and then it also includes meditation, so mindfulness and concentration in the Eightfold Path. So that's a little bit about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths that you maybe have heard before, but I think it's a great thing to remember. There's this destination, this is where we're going, and therefore when we sit down for Zazen, it's not just concentration. Or if we're practicing the precepts, it's not just to do good. All these things work together to support right view and that cessation of discontent. So one way that we could say that Zazen is not just the concentration part, how that ties into right view, is we sit down to sit Zazen, and maybe at the beginning of the period we can think about San Francisco or a little bit of what we're doing, why we got on this road in the first place. So this is about let's just briefly examine in our experience, not so much trying to remember all the words, but is there some discontent here right now when I'm sitting in the Zendo? Because sometimes we can just spend a whole period of Zazen kind of just stewing in discontent. Maybe that's happened for some of you. And it might even be discontent that we can't get concentrated, right? I was content until I came in here, and then tried to my distracted mind, I can't get it under control. Now I'm leaving the room totally suffering, because I'm just such a lousy Zen practitioner. So therefore we're working on the concentration part, but we've lost sight of the overall context. So we're sitting there, we can't concentrate, and just to start looking at, oh, what is this? It's kind of an investigation. What is this discontent? I'm holding to some idea that I should be more concentrated, for example. And how does that work? And just by examining it, sometimes then we, the whole thing kind of settles down. And then we just settle into a more present and concentrated Zazen just by stepping back to check it out for a minute. So let me stop here anyway for now and see if you have any questions, especially questions about the path of practice, the basic, like, the roadmap, clarifying the roadmap. Yes?
So, are you saying that the classic understanding of right view is the Four Noble Truths, or is that just a part of it?
Yes, so in these, I mean, there's many sutras, and right now I'm just talking about the first turning in the we call the Pali Canon, the early sutras, because later we could say right view is the view of mind only, from the mind only school perspective. That would be the definitive view, would be that there's no objects outside the mind. But since right now we're just talking, that's why there's, you could say that's when you drag that that Google road line over to the mind only school, it'll give you a different map, mm-hmm. but the same destination. And some people like me like to drag it over there. I like that mind only. But in this early view, yeah, the early teachings, the Buddha says, in many places, he basically says these two, the conventional right view about the workings of karma, good and bad, kind of dualistic, wholesome and unwholesome, leading to happiness and unhappiness. And then and that goes quite far in the conventional world, but it doesn't lead to the full cessation of suffering. It's more than just good karma, and that more is called the understanding of the Four Noble Truths is right view.
But then you could also say that with the further developments, that it's all just ways to help us, alleviate suffering and let go of our grasping mind.
Yeah, that's true.
There's various paths that Buddhists have evolved, continue even to this day.
Yep.
But that's really what it's about.
Yeah.
And that's right view, is understanding that.
Yeah.
So that's what we're up to.
Yeah. You know, in Zen, we don't talk about, classic, like Dogen and all his volumes of writing hardly ever mentions the Four Noble Truths. Maybe like one sentence in 1,000 pages. Kind of interesting, huh? But you could say all of his writings are aiming in the same direction. They're just a very different approach. Zazen, you could say, in its heart, is about finding this ease. But like I say, we can think, oh, it's just about getting concentrated. Or getting really, being really relaxed. And it does have those benefits, Zazen, I'm talking about. We talk about mindfulness-based stress reduction. There's a whole movement in America now. And I think it's a great thing. And that, because stress is another name for suffering. But if we think that that's the full extent, if it's just about reducing a conventional stress from a busy day and relaxing, that's a great thing, but then that might be like Half Moon Bay. Like San Francisco's even further. It's like the complete cessation of any kind of constriction based on this wrong understanding, because we don't even need any really understanding. We need a little bit maybe, but not much to just sit. And I think Zen often is like that. We're like, we don't need all these teachings, just sit. And it does. It does actually relieve a lot. But I would propose, this might be controversial, but if we don't have the full roadmap, that Zen will only lead to Half Moon Bay. So therefore, I think we need Dharma teachings, and I don't think there were any Zen teachers who said, you don't need to study or hear any Dharma, just sit and that's all. Even Dogen, who really emphasizes, just sit. Apart from reading sutras and offering incense and all this, just wholeheartedly sit. And then he wrote like 1,000 pages for us to read, right? So, clarifying the view, I think, is so important. And you could say all these other schools also are talking about the Four Noble Truths, but in different language. Yes?
I was just watching videos of, the Dalai Lama talking And he was talking about, like, the primordial mind and the basic mind, and how, like, the whole system of Buddhism is, like, paths to get to this primordial mind, which is bliss. I'm just paraphrasing, I might be saying it wrong, but, so then he was saying that, like, when you get to the primordial mind, sometimes you get there with afflictions. So it's like remnants of the basic mind are still there. And so I was just thinking that that's, like, not the mind way, right? The mind way is the Zen. Where you just, or maybe not Zen, but just there's the mind way, and then there's this way that the Dalai Lama was talking about.
The primordial mind way versus the mind way.
Yeah, I mean, the way I'm interpreting it is that, you know, it's almost like you're doing the mind way, and that's there, but then there's this jump into the primordial mind, which is the blissful path to enlightenment.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Well, I would understand that, that him to be talking about another name that we sometimes use in our tradition and the Dalai Lama's tradition for this primordial mind that we've been talking about this fall is Buddha nature. That Buddha nature is this, like, we could say kind of like unstained, perfectly pure nature of mind with no more discontent. And we could call that sometimes primordial mind, and you could say that it's blocked by, like, the dualistic mind, our everyday dualistic mind. If you know, sometimes it's talked about that way, that our dualistic thinking obscures this radiant, clear, compassionate, free Buddha nature. So that's one of the views, is from a certain type of teachings, that's one path, you could say, is the realization of Buddha nature or primordial mind. And there's different paths. The Dalai Lama might have a different way of talking about it than Dogen. But, you know, having heard the way the Dalai Lama does talk about that some, and Dogen talking about it, they're actually quite similar, I think. Sometimes they sound kind of different on the surface, but they're using different language and a slightly different approach, but I think not that different. So I think you got to hear the whole context that he's, you know, watched from the very beginning to the end of the video. Get the whole, like, context in which he's speaking it, about it. But that sometimes the third noble truth of cessation is also called nirvana, which could be a way of looking at this. Nirvana is said to be unconditioned, it doesn't come and go, and it's blissful peace, even in the early teachings. So we could say that's kind of like a primordial mind. And of course, in our tradition, we try not to get caught up in dualities. So we hear about, well, that mind sounds so great, and my measly little mind here is so different than that. So then we hear that actually they're not, they're right there, like, completely not separate. Our ordinary mind and Buddha nature. But how that's so is very subtle and difficult to talk about. Therefore, the right view in that particular path, a lot needs to be said. It's harder to maybe talk about than the Four Noble Truths. But I'd say it's going the same place. The very center of San Francisco. Central Park. Where there's just lush green fields that you can run through without bumping into anyone. And maybe even play frisbee. So, anything else?
part of me that always wants to go somewhere else. Go to San Francisco.
You could say that's the second noble truth.
Yeah, is kind of trying to get into Santa Cruz, just, you know, to really totally open my mind to the Santa Cruz that I am in.
That's a path to when you plot the whole path to San Francisco, and then you see like, oh, I'm like really trying to get there, and then you're more and more focused on this journey, and then you see you actually arrive in what you think is the center of Central Park. And you start looking around and you see, this is actually San Lorenzo Park. So sometimes, maybe like that, you're so absorbed in just being present on this journey that you realize that you actually didn't go anywhere. And San Francisco is not like a long way, far away. And it's kind of like that sometimes we hear about San Francisco to get us really concentrated on the road, and then when we're really concentrated on the road, then we arrive in this park that's we realize, well, you can play frisbee right here in San Lorenzo Park. It's not actually the San Francisco that I thought I was going to, but it's exactly the grass and spacious fields that you can run through that was the reason I started in the first place.
Anyway, there's kind of that stream in me, and then there's the other stream in me where I have the urge to go, but I don't even really care where it is. I don't want to look at a map. I might look at a map once I get there, like, oh, this is kind of interesting. But the trip itself is what, just that feeling of freedom of not knowing anything about where I am and just being open to what's, what's happening on the way there. Maybe I know it's just this analogy. But it makes me think, like, this is why I'm not a very, goal-oriented person. And so that kind of trying to get from here to there seems to, in my life, have always kind of just brought suffering. Because I'm suffering the sense of disconnect, of a discontent that I'm not, wherever there is. So it seems like now in my life I'm just trying to be more just here, wherever here is.
Well, that's really interesting, yeah. Maybe it is where the metaphor breaks down.
Yes.
Or you could say the metaphor or analogy of driving to San Francisco still works, but this gets into the subtlety of once we're on the journey. I mean, you could say even if you just go out for a joyride to just drive around in the country and just come home again, you don't even know which roads you're going to take. Even that, you have some intention to set out to do that.
Right.
So,
so there is some.
Yeah. Yes.
On her situation, like operating without a map is, in substance, you can be seeing yourself as in the stream, but maybe not having all the skills to manage it. It's kind of like a young fish learning to swim in the stream with its currents and things. You don't need all the strength and the skill to navigate. But with the stream, as it really flows in a deeper, more subjective way.
So maybe it's some kind of combination of in order to get you in the car, you kind of have some idea that you're at least going to just drive around town for fun. And then sometimes then you can change the goal along the way. You can also reassess.
I'm sort of thinking that, like, a reassessment from my view is that she's made it into the stream. She's found the stream. in a real life situation. Now it's just a matter of developing the skills and navigating the greater skill.
Yeah, you know, I have to remember it's just an analogy that actually, like, I wasn't even thinking of before this talk. It kind of spontaneously arose. So, but the view of where we're going, I think especially, you know, long-term practitioners, just to keep checking in with, like, what's our intention? Where are we going? You know? And it might be that where we're going, what we really, our deep intention, where we really want to go, is to just be at ease with whatever situation we're in. That's kind of the San Francisco we're talking about.
Plan. So she's really, with the plan's messed you up. But
I can also see the suffering and not having any plan at all. So okay. I guess I'm feeling that too.
Could go either way. Yeah. Yes. Last question.
Okay. Well, I think this is just an example of that there's different sides, and that at different times mm-hmm. you need different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes maybe if you're a person that's always just fixated on a goal, it's really important to learn how to let go
yeah.
and flow.
Yeah.
But if you're a person that's just always flowing and nothing ever really happens and you're kind of lost, then it might be good to focus on something. And I think that our teaching gives us
that's a great point.
Both sides to flow.
Yeah.
Flow.
Yeah. See where we're getting stuck.
And upaya, you know, mm-hmm. being
yep.
integrative.
Yep. Okay. That was the last question, this is just a half a question.
It's just a reminder of what Catherine sometimes would tell us about attending to the ordinary, the dailiness around us, the life that we have in the present, even as we're tempted to elsewhere, like San Francisco.
Yeah, and you could say the reason we're doing that, we're attending to each moment of ordinary life, is to be free from this constriction around getting something for ourselves, getting something. Remember, the third noble truth is talking about a cessation. So it's not getting something, it's losing something. But you could say the reason we're just being present with what's happening is to find the freedom there. So there's still always like a kind of a, you could say that's the goal. Maybe we don't think of it that way. But often we're not. We're getting distracted by all different things. We're not just paying attention to the things in our life. So you could say that's an intentional direction. That's why maybe the San Francisco thing sounds too dualistic, or it sounds like it's putting the thing out there. Because the thing out there is where the metaphor breaks down. Because the San Francisco we're going, of course, is no other place.
It's the idea of elsewhere.
Than here. Yeah, it's no other place. And yet, if we're really constricted, where is the freedom? It's right there, but we can, if we didn't see any difference, then I don't think there is any practice. Maybe that's the end, that there is no practice. So with that, we dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to all discontent beings throughout space and time. May they clarify their roadmap to here. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.